Welcome everyone back to the Sunday Roast, and we have some fabulous guests for you. Lisa, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hey guys, yeah, my name is Lisa Burton. I'm a British migrant who's living in Spain. I'm vice chair of a citizens' rights groups called Remain in Spain. It's a mouthful, isn't it? And I'm on the board of European Movement UK, but today I'm here in a solely personal capacity.
Awesome. Peter, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hello, I'm a lorry driver who in 2019 became a bit of a political activist, which led on to founding with my partner in crime, Lee Rudd, National Joy March, which is an answer to having left the EU.
And my beautiful co-host?
Hi, my name's Big Match Studios. I run my own channel called the Big Match Studios channel, along with this podcast with Alex.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm an author, historian, journalist, and political scientist. Right, let's get to it. Rachel Reeves, is she a liar? Have any of you ever faked your CVs? Let's get straight into
it. I've inflated some times I was at a certain workplace, but I never lied aside from that. So I'd say I was at a place slightly longer than I was. But I mean,
that's a lie, isn't it?
It's not as bad as claiming I was an economist when I worked in a customer service. Those are two different things. So
I'm lucky. I've never really had a CV, not since I was a teenager anyway. My business always worked for myself. So I can't really say that. But I do know I employ people and I know people embellish on their CVs. And I find this one quite.
Mine just says failed all the GCSEs, joined the army, lorry driver for 20 years. That's my CV. Dead easy. I can't lie.
That's it. Straight to the point.
I could say I'm a pilot instead of a lorry driver, I guess.
Land pilot, would that be? Or that's a pretty cool name for a lorry driver.
Yeah. I'll get a plate made up.
I suppose it's like, what's a lie and what's an embellishment? You know, like there's a little bit of difference. With Rachel Reeves, I've had a look through it, actually, and I can really see there are some strange kind of fixes and anomalies there. You know what I mean? And the fact is, because she's chancellor, she doesn't need to be an economist. You know, like Gordon Brown, George Osborne, I think, what do they study? History or something like that? Do you know what I mean?
Like and politics, philosophy and economics, I think, PPE or something like that.
Yeah, so, I think there was a history as well. But yeah, it's not a good look, is it?
I mean, the CV wasn't to apply for the job as chancellor, was it? I'm not being a div, am I? For an old job or something, they found this CV.
When you flex your credentials on LinkedIn and people say, oh, she's an economist, she worked at the Bank of England for this many years and this and that, and then you look at her budget and you're like, man, the Bank of England didn't teach you much, dog. You didn't learn much. You didn't learn much at the Bank of England, huh? Mark Carney was not in charge when you were there, clearly.
So it is on a LinkedIn then, she said. Yeah.
She also said in an interview that she was with the Bank of England for 10 years or a decade, which was just not true. I think she was there from 2006.
Wasn't it like majority of a decade, wasn't it? And she'd been there for years. And it always sounds better when you say a decade than it said.
Half a decade, which is actually closer.
Just over half a decade. Yeah, that would be it.
Yeah, it's like the National Joy March when we said there was 20,000 and there was about 12 of us.
So much crazy flack. I don't understand it. Yeah. I keep getting these right wingers coming up on Twitter. Oh, there are only 12 of you there. That's not what the video footage shows.
There's 12 people running the stage. You know what I mean?
What were your numbers last year? Are you going to inflate as well? Are you going to do a bit? We're going to change it. You're going to Rachel Reeves it.
Year one was 50. I get my numbers directly from the police liaison officer on the day, right there on the ground, and they have to know numbers. They say they don't count, but they have to know numbers because they have to know how many police to have ready to deploy, because they've told me that. So year one was 15,000. Year two was 20,000. And last year was down to 15,000 again on the march. But then most people didn't stay for the rally because Parliament Square was ruined because of the rain, a week of rain before it. But yeah, I was expecting the numbers to be down, though, because it was so close after the election. And I think so many people burnt out. Some people like, let's give Labour a chance. So there's no need for the protest now. But I just felt we had to do it because Labour's did, well, they're still not, are they? It was in PMQs just yesterday, Starmer's still wanging on about no to customs union, no to single market, no to this, no to that, no to anything whatsoever that's actually going to help the country.
Apart from a defence security agreement and big match, as you pointed out last week, somewhat towards going over to places and saying hello and claiming that you've got some sort of connection.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a good trip to Germany, to France, to Italy, you know, albeit his pictures in Italy weren't as good as Sunak's. I'll never get over those. I don't think I'll never stop talking about those pictures because that was something. But, you know, he's not really done a lot in terms of, I think, building connections with people or leaders. They're waiting to see what we actually want. And we don't know what we want. We're just going to rule out stuff. So we don't have a lot. And I think on the back of these net migration, we're talking about Reeves, to be fair. He could fudge the numbers, to be fair. He could be like, no, it's not that many people. No, we could Reeves this one. We could Reeves this one, yeah. You know, we could just say, no.
What you just said right there, it's like, it reminds me when I ask my other half what she wants for dinner, and she says, well, I don't want this, and I don't want that, and I don't want this. I'm like, I asked you what you want.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah. So
what do you want?
I've got the net immigration tab on my computer open. I'm looking at it. I'm realizing, oh, wait, I've got a chance to dunk on Reeves here, who I don't actually like very much, so I might as well take it. I mean, she claimed she was an economist working at HBOS, which was the, I think, their Scottish division. She wasn't. She worked in retail. And it's just like, I don't care if the Chancellor doesn't have an economics degree. Like, it doesn't make that much of a difference considering the Treasury is full of a bunch of, like, accounting nerds and the OBR is full of a bunch of accounting nerds. So it's not that bad. But I do take issue with the fact that she tried to flex her credentials on national TV. And then you're just like, but you don't have those. So it makes yourself look more stupid, especially when the budget was a bit of a joke.
It's one thing, isn't it? Like lying on LinkedIn, but then going on TV and showing them everyone your LinkedIn is a bit of a thing to do, isn't it?
Laura Koonsberg.
Sorry, Madge.
Laura Koonsberg's going straight for this one. You can tell. Like, you can just. she's so happy. She's excited to see this. Yeah,
she is. I think that a lot of people on the left are not taking a lot of notice of it, because, as much as probably we should, you know. And that is because there's so much sleaze has come from the Tories. I mean, I'm like, when I first heard it, because I didn't look into the detail, I agree it's wrong. I mean, they have to, you know, I'm all for integrity and honesty in politics and trust and stuff like that. And we all know Labour are held to a higher standard by the media than the Tories ever were, you know. But I think it was Richard Holden, you know, he's going absolutely apoplectic about it and saying it's very serious, you know. But then it's like people saying, well, what about Grant Shapps, you know? You know, what's his name? Richard Green or something.
Michael Green.
You know? Michael Green, sorry, yeah, Michael Green. Do you know what I mean? And who probably wouldn't have faced as much scrutiny, from parliamentarians, at least on his own party, when that came out. And I think that was the only time I ever agreed with Michael Fabricant when he said he wouldn't buy a used car off Grant Shapps. You know, I think that was the only time I ever agreed with him. But it's not a good look. You know, we hated the lies and the misinformation and all of that under the Tories. So we have to hold Labour to the same standards, and it's just not a good look. And like I said, they've got a hard enough battle on their hands with the right-wing press anyway. The last thing they want to do is do stupid bloody things like this and, you know, the gifts and the donate. It's just get your act together. You know, you have to be squeaky clean, do the right thing. That's what I say to it.
It's funny, though, because they got embellished, didn't they, when over Partygate, when some photos, some journalists had obviously stalked outside Starmer's headquarters and he was sat there having a beer and a curry. And they were trying to make out that was somehow similar to Johnson literally having lines of champagne covered in tinsel, like having nine parties,
ramble,
DJs, carrying.
Did you say lines of champagne?
Lines of something.
Allegedly. You said lines of champagne. Yeah. I don't know if you got two things mixed up there, or you know.
No, you never know. It's
straw.
Like, we're talking about basically embellishing on a CV, and then the real problem was the fact she tried to brag that she was something that
seems that she's not. But also, you know, comparing that to the stuff they've got to, I mean, I made that line of champagne comment. There's coke inside Westminster. There's no arguing about that. And it's in the most secure area of Westminster. Mm. Only people like the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary and the Chancellor could go.
It's a very narrow list. It's a narrow list of it's a narrow list of people it could be. So you never know. With the CV thing, like I said, I think
they do random drug tests at my work. I don't see why they shouldn't do it in Parliament.
Well, they call Starmer a special case, so I don't think they could test them. That's true. That's actually true.
Is that really true?
Oh
my God.
Special K.
Could you imagine him doing something like that? Can't picture him doing drugs.
Nah, he's too straight. Too straight.
He's way too straight. I mean, even the stuff with... we're going in a different direction, as I said. The stuff with the ICP and taking on board their case, not case, but their determination that Netanyahu is going to be charged. I mean, that's quite wild. And you're going, he just seems like someone who just sticks to law and will not bend. I mean, we could talk about the donations as well that you mentioned, and the fact that he took all those suits and everything else. Mm. And that's within the law, so he goes, that's okay. But ethically, you go, no, you don't need that. You've got a solid wage. You should be able to afford it. You're also a millionaire from what... I mean, that's correct, isn't it? He and his wife are both.
I believe it's him. I don't know if his wife has that much money, but it's definitely him. But I just... That whole thing, you know, I saw a lot of people defending it based on legal principle. It's like, nah, mate, the ethics of it are really bad. Mm. And it's like, what do these people want who give donations? They'll give it for free. And I saw a lot of Labour MPs argue, well, they got nothing back. It's like, there's a lot of... You know, there's a lot of time left in this Parliament.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, the Tories didn't get their donations back until COVID hit. You know, when you look at things like carbon capture, you're like, it's a bit dodgy that, you know, some of the policies they come out with, you know, the fact that you're shouting out BlackRock on Twitter and you're like one of the worst companies in the world and you shout them out on Twitter, that's a bit weird.
BlackRock is the world's largest asset manager, controlling trillions of dollars and influencing many industries. Critics say it cares more about profit than people, pointing to its big investments in fossil fuels, which harm the environment. It also advises governments while investing in industries, raising concerns about conflicts of interest and too much power in one company's hands. This has led some to call it one of the most harmful companies in the world.
I worked out it'd be cheaper to plant trees across the Northern Sahara, and it would be as effective, if not more effective, to do that than it is to do the carbon capture program. So you would green it up. You would therefore, if you did it correctly in the way they're doing it in the south with the green wall, you would then bring farming back into the area, which then stabilizes the economy more, which then stops such a heavy flood, or has the potential to help reduce the amount of people coming over the Mediterranean. And you're going, that's a far more effective solution. And it does two things. Where, as you've just said, carbon capture, I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it doesn't.
There isn't any real evidence. There was a great video put out, I can't remember who it was by, but they were talking about the how carbon capture is completely ineffective, and the fact that it's just a bung to companies. Wow. And so that's all it is, because all it does is these companies, they get loads of money to put this carbon, I think, under the water or something like that, under the ocean or wherever they're located, and they don't do it. So it doesn't make sense.
I think I read that they could put solar on basically every house in the UK for the same amount of money. Like, what would you... why wouldn't you go for that? You know what I mean? Or real investment in real renewable energies, you know, solar farms, wind, sea, you know, tidal. I find that a really strange one.
Have these houses put donations into the Labour Party or Starmer? Maybe you got to donate some money, you know?
Does that actually mean that you just have to give him a suit and therefore you
can... An expensive suit, you know, one where he doesn't have a tailor for, which drove me nuts. Because I looked at it and I'm like, my man, like, could Lord Ali not afford a tailor for you?
Jesus Christ. If I want us to rejoin the EU, instead of wasting money on a march every year, we just need to buy Starmer a new hat or something.
Two suits and
two suits.
A hat. I feel like he'd wear a hat.
And a hat. Right, let's do it.
Get him the bomber jacket. You know when Laura Kunzberg was talking about the centrist dad look, and I was like, what are you talking about? Do you get your talking points off Twitter? Can the BBC not afford a research team?
A centrist what?
Centrist dad.
Centrist dad.
Because you know when he was at the football stadiums, he wore like a bomber jacket. And I'm like, do you want him to wear his suit at the bloody game? A non-league game? He's going to go there in his Lord Ali suit. Be like, yeah, I'm Sir Keir Starmer. I've come here to watch football. Like, get lost.
Like he's a character.
Yeah. Knight of the Realm.
I don't know. It's a bit disappointing seeing this stuff. It was interesting you were talking about the solar panels, though. So I take this with a pinch of salt, but Elon Musk claimed that you could power the whole of the United States with 100-mile-square set of solar panels. Now, obviously, you can't put it in one place because you wouldn't be able to direct the electricity everywhere else. But you could, in theory, put 5 sets of 20-mile solar panels across the states in each corner and a couple in the middle. And then you would be able to, he claims you need batteries as well. But I thought, isn't that wild to think that he made that claim? I don't know how true that is, but I did run the calculations and I did find that you could power London by putting solar panels across all the rail tracks and roads. So if you covered that entire territory with solar panels, I'm not saying it's doable, I'm just saying it's a hypothetical, but if you attempted to do that, there'd be enough electricity generated across London on a good day, and obviously you need batteries, to probably power London. And I thought that was quite wild. I've never heard anyone say anything quite like that.
I sometimes go down YouTube rabbit holes, and I went down a mega project one once, and it was one of them videos was about some project they're thinking about of in the Sahara Desert, putting massive, massive farms of solar panels there to power the world, basically. But I think the major problem is not really putting the panels there, it's, as you just said, distributing it to the world, sort of thing.
They need cables, the underwater cables that we have between us and France. And the other problem is, I think it's ownership as well, like who would actually own the solar panels?
Yeah.
Like, would it be them or us? And I think that's one of the big problems.
Something like that, you'd need to get everyone in the world, every country in the world, to just say, let's just do this. And get together and do it, wouldn't you? That's never going to happen, ever, is it? But, you know,
it's definitely possible, but it's about connectivity. You know, that's where the major infrastructure has to go, in storage, connectivity and storage. But there's some connective new connections between Europe and the UK going on now, I believe. I know there's one between France and Belgium. Or something, but yeah.
Are you talking about defense packs? Are you talking about electrical cables between
electrical cables? Electrical cables.
Is there a connection there?
Starmer's he's got to ask BlackRock nicely for them to build it.
That segues us really nicely into how's it going with Brexit? Our weekly analysis.
It's amazing.
Reset. Is it amazing, Peter? Are you feeling joy? Do you feel as if your marches are finally punching through Starmer's brain? Interesting.
Do you know what? As a lorry driver, it actually, and it grips my, it annoys me. I won't swear to save you some editing. It annoys me, let's say, because everyone thinks we've got it great because of Brexit. Because I say, well, your wages have gone up, and I say, well, yeah, actually, my wages have gone up 3 times since Brexit. But all 3 times inflation was higher than my wages went up by. So I've always been out of pocket. And to this day, you know, my wages haven't gone up anything like inflation, like most people. So that is a myth and is complete nonsense anyway. It's only true if you completely ignore inflation, but you can't do that, can you? That myth is nonsense. All it's really done for us is made our job really hard. Because there's now less drive. The world has got a lorry driver shortage at the moment, and has done for years and years. The whole world has, right? But everyone is on like just about coping levels, you could say. But this country, because we've left the single market, and so many of their drivers went back home, and then more went over back home because of COVID on top of it. And then Brexit came in properly, and now that you don't earn enough as a lorry driver to pass that limit that I think it's Priti Patel set, wasn't it, that you have to burn over a certain amount before you can come over now. Lorry drivers don't earn over that, most lorry drivers, especially lorry drivers in the EU, because a lot of them are paid by the kilometre, rather than by the hour or by the day. That's why they don't want to sit in Dover for 3 days, because they're not getting paid for it. So it's just made things hard for us. So there's less drivers, but there's more work to do. We're just getting driven into the ground, basically. And there's going to be accidents on the road because of tired drivers for all of this. And it's because of Brexit, the staff shortages, and it ain't getting better. And it's not going to get better, as far as I can tell, unless you open up and welcome more immigrants to the country, not do what Starmer's doing, which is the opposite of that. And just Starmer, I heard him today, right, at that press conference. I don't know if you guys did. And he was saying, right, the numbers need to come down, but he would not say a level. What number do they need to? If you're saying they need to come down, what number do they need to come down to, and why? Do you know what I mean? He's doing exactly what all of the rest of us does and say, oh yeah, we'll bring immigration down. That's what the racists want to fucking. Sorry,
it really annoying.
Racists want to hear.
Yeah, it's just no one is speaking up about the necessity of immigration, the benefits of immigration, what would happen to the country without immigration. Do you know what I mean? And meanwhile, they've got this huge section of society, their minds are being poisoned and they're being exploited, you know, by the messaging, like from Farage and stuff like that. It's one of my biggest gripes, obviously, always has been, you know, since Brexit. It's this disgusting conversation around Brexit. It's immigration. And I just want someone to be honest. You know, the British people need to be told the facts. Yeah, I think it was in the 1970s, there's four workers for every pensioner. And that was like 2.2. Okay, so it's like, where, you know, we need these people. You know, you can't have a functioning country growth. You know, I mean, capitalists, I mean, Farage is a capitalist. He's arguing against immigration. What would happen to the country without immigration? You know, they never discuss these things.
Unless you're really rich. Yes. Farage loves immigration for really rich people, if you've seen that video that led by Duncan's released.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And he's always talking about it being economic migrants. But then you look at the stats and you can see that actually it's in correlation to when there's a big war or when we've taken out a government and caused chaos in the Middle East or North Africa. Because, you know, that's always a great way to create stability and stop migration. Those stats were quite interesting as well. I think, actually, I'll throw them out. I'm going to give a shout out to Jimmy the Giant, because we were talking about him off air and we just watched his documentary. He came up with some great stats. What do you think the population is in terms of, I think it's number of people have migrated into the country? What do you think the percentage is of essentially non-British?
Currently.
Present moment in time, what do you think it is? Because it seems like it's been embellished in the
past. I think it was about 11%, weren't it?
You think it's,
was it about 11% or something like that?
11, Lisa?
No idea. So right. You're talking about British people coming into Britain? No, I didn't. No,
we're living in the UK. People,
what percentage of the UK is
non British? I think it's 14%.
I think 14, Peter,
I think it was 11, 12. I think it was 12,
13.
Oh, fuck.
I think they've been polling done on this and they've been asked them what they think the actual number is. And they're getting figures back of 33%. And you're going, what the fuck? Where have you got those numbers from? They're just wildly inaccurate. And you've got these people going around saying, oh, towns are being taken over and, oh, it's causing all sorts of issues.
The thing is, is it about British-born people that weren't born here? Is that what the...
Figure. Yeah.
So they would look at me and they'll see a foreigner even though I was born here. And that's what the problem is.
Yeah.
That's where the discrepancy comes from.
That's where I've heard that conversation as well. I've had friends of mine who were like born here and come up to me and go, I'll never forget it. It was one guy who was like, London accent, born here, parents were Sri Lanka. And he was like, I'm Sri Lankan, aren't I? And we were like, what the hell are you talking about? It's like, well, I'm not a Londoner, am I? I'm not British. And I was like, you have a British accent, and then I'm like, you're born here, right? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, then why on earth do you think that you're not British? And it's obviously, for him and his Sri Lankan heritage, he was like, he thought he was connected to that part of the world. And then we were like, do you speak, I think it's Tamil, is that the correct language for Sri Lanka?
One of the languages, yeah.
We said, do you speak any Tamil? And she's like, no. So, like, you could go over there and you wouldn't be able to, like, you'd have to really work hard to be able to get a life over there because you don't even speak the language. And then I had another friend of mine who, I think his parents were diplomats from Kenya. And this was under Theresa May this happened. But basically, from the age of six, he'd been in the UK. He traveled and stayed in different parts of the world. But at the age of six, he was in the UK up until the age of 18, and he only spoke English. He said, when May came in, he had to send off a passport into the Home Office to prove that actually he was a British citizen, even though all he could do was speak English, and his entire history, from his perspective, was in Britain, and all his friends were here, and his culture was here. They lost his passport in the Home Office and deported him to a country he'd never been to.
There's so many cases like this. I know. Dreadful.
And I couldn't believe it when he was telling me this. I was thinking, I couldn't believe that they lost his passport. I didn't actually... I was like, something else has happened here, surely.
Has there been like a programme like ITV did for the post office about this kind of thing? There needs to be something like that made for this, just to show, because people don't listen until... human stories are sort of told. Do you know what I mean? People just hear stats and political view this, political that. Until you see human stories behind all these policies and that, I don't think people will listen, because there's still people waiting for compensation and stuff, isn't there, for all of that as well?
Windrush
and that, yeah.
For compensation, many of them have died. It's just disgusting. And
it's gross.
Even with EU migrants now living in the UK, like as a British migrant living in the EU, I have a identity card, like a TIE, it's called. It's biometric. I can travel on it. I have access to services on it and stuff like that. And every person has to be given one of them. That came under the Brexit withdrawal agreement. In the UK, EU citizens have no such thing because the UK government, Boris Johnson, it would be too expensive to put in place. So if you're an EU citizen, you're relying on this digital site telling you your status. If it goes down, you haven't got access. There's so many issues with it. You know, you've got no physical evidence to give to an employer, landlords. It's creating havoc. They've been EU citizens in the UK for 30, 40 years that are now hitting these barriers and having to prove it's a shambles, you know, and it's something that the 3 million are fighting for, and even Remain in Spain that I work for, we really support, is physical proof of your status as an immigrant. It's so important to stop, what if there was a huge cyber attack? All those records are gone. You know, there's so much that can go wrong there, you know, in an IP system and stuff like that. So it's a big challenge for EU migrants, in particular in the UK, because if you've got a work visa, you've got your work visa, and it's short term, and, you know, it's not like settled status and semi-settled or semi-permanent settled status and stuff like that. So it's a huge thing. And I think personally, it's another Windrush in the making down the line. If there was a government that would come in and take a really another hard view and a hard look on immigration, like reform, for example, you know.
What's your? We'll go back to you, Lisa, on that. I just want to track back a bit, Madge. What's your experience been of this then? So I gave those two anecdotal stories. Have you ever had anything similar to that?
People don't really talk to me about that kind of stuff, or no one really. Like, I have both headphones on. So if anyone tries to give me any abuse, I don't hear it. So it's very rare, like, you know, for me. I think there's always the thing of, like, you had Andy Murray talk about when he wins, he's British, when he loses, he's Scottish. You know, like, there's always been, like, Lukaku talked about it, Ozil talked about it. So I think there's always been a problem when it comes to people kind of born in a country that are from minority backgrounds. So I think that'll always be a problem. You know, the Theresa May go home fans was crazy, in my opinion. And that's what I mean. Like, I think there's a big problem with trying to talk tough about immigration in the UK, whereas, you know they need immigration to grow the economy. And so it's always been the biggest problem the Tories have had, because Cameron talked about bringing immigration in the tens of thousands, never could do it. It just wasn't feasible. And so that's why Starmer hasn't given a target, because it can be held accountable. you know, if he gets the number, you know, lower than, you say, 10 than it is now, he's technically done what he wanted, which is he's cut net migration, which is what he wants. So, like, that's the reason why he won't set a number on it. You know, the idea that we can get the fastest growing economy in the G7, but also, you know, not, you know, cut down massive on immigration is a complete farce. But that's what I mean. He made, you know, goals. He talked about things which were never going to work.
Yeah.
And, you know, essentially, there were a lot of people defending it. And now you've got to ask yourself, do you want to cut net migration or do you want to grow the economy? Which one do you want?
Well, that's the thing. He doesn't, there's so much within that. I think he does know what he's saying. And I think he's just dodging the question, like he's been doing quite a lot ever since he's been in. I think there's also an element of, just going back to what Lisa said, Gibraltar has 15,000 Spanish immigrants come over the border every day. If he wants to pull something like this, is that going to apply over there? Like, you're meant to be in charge of the border and the security, but it also means Gibraltarians coming into Spain, they need an ID card, a red one, to be able to feel safe enough to be able to travel over. There's also an exception. If you're over 75, no one's giving you private insurance to travel at the present moment in time. So I'm being told by people in Gibraltar, and I actually had a conversation with my old man about this, and they're like, I can't get medical insurance to travel into Europe. And I'm like, that's wild. So anyone over the age of 75 can't do this? Going back onto what you were saying, Madge, like, let's go into migration in full then. Like, there's something to be said about that. It's 900,000, I think, Lisa, you said is the number.
906,000 it was to the year ending June 2023. And it's 724,000 to the year ending June 2024 this year. So, yeah, so that was a shocker. But they just added on 150,000 the ONS, you know, and that has to be released. It's an incredible amount of people. But I have seen some data, and I can't remember where it's from, but Britain needs 350,000 extra people a year, I believe. Roughly up until about 2030 to kind of stabilize the economy and to bring some growth. It's quite a chunk. But obviously, so many people left after Brexit and COVID. You know, they don't talk about this at 400,000 Polish people who have left. Yeah. It's very difficult to find those exact figures because I've kind of tried to look into that, how many European citizens have left the UK, so they would all have to be replaced, of course, in the workforce. But then, of course, you've got Ukraine and Hong Kong as well, which has certainly elevated the figures as well.
That's a good chunk of the figures, isn't it? Ukraine and Hong Kong.
I think it was about 280,000. I think it was
the both of them.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think something like that.
I hate how it's reported like it's such a massive, oh no, all these people. And Richard Tice put something on Twitter, and he annoys me on Twitter, he does. I need to calm down a bit sometimes, especially when I'm NRM on there. But yeah, we put up, I've lost track of what I was saying now. He posted something
about immigration.
Yeah.
He posted to it, I assume.
Yeah, but I can't remember what he posted or while replied. So
it was just about some of the numbers being so high.
That's a problem.
Have to bring it down and da-da-da-da, labour.
It was something specific, but I'm going to find it right now because I can't let it just go there. Right, so he put mass immigration update, like in capital letters, approaching 2 million net permanent arrivals. No wonder we can't see a doctor or get a hospital appointment. No wonder housing rents are so high. No wonder we're all getting poorer. I honestly, if he was stood in front of me, I don't know how I'd be able to contain my anger, to be honest. So I just quoted it and put, but we have shortages in almost every sector. So we need people. Therefore, the problem isn't people, is it? The problem is not building infrastructure for these people. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Not the people. But you never hear them talking about that.
No.
You never hear them talking about housing. You never hear them talking about things that will really fix the problems we do genuinely have in this country. They just wang on about immigrants and blame them people there, and it, it, It drives me mental, to be honest.
It's either a grift or it's so ideologically driven. If they got into power and let's say they knocked the numbers down to 50,000,
it's racism as far as I'm concerned. That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's racism and xenophobia and nationalism and all those dirty things rolled together. Yeah,
it's an easy attack line for them because they turned immigration into a massive toxic issue, along with the help of the Conservative Party, the Labour Party now, and the media. And so what they did is by turning it into a toxic issue, it's an easy stick to beat the government with. It's, you've let immigrants in and it's causing all of these problems. Where it's like, we have a massive housing problem as is because of planning permission, as well as not building sustainable housing. We have a problem with GPs because the Tories cut funding towards, I think, training GPs and things like that. And the fact that they refused to put funding in for medical schools. So they took foreign students instead. Yeah. So, you know, there are like literally government decisions that led us to this mess. But it's easy to bring immigrants because it's such an easy attack line. You know, I'll never go over Farage saying all of Romania could be here by tea time. Yeah. And you just like, and go where, mate? And he won that debate with those kind of nonsensical arguments because the host didn't want to step in and say anything. Clegg was inept as a debater. And that was it. He won based on complete nonsense. And that's what I mean. Immigration is such an easy attack line in this country because there aren't many pro-immigration, you know, migrant countries in Europe. I think Spain is probably the only one or one of the few. That's about it. Like, as for the rest, it's just an easy stick to beat politicians with because at the end of the day, they know economic growth versus migration. You want economic growth because it sounds better. But when times are bad, like they are now, they blame foreign people always.
Very proud of Sanchez at the moment for being that one voice in Europe who's really speaking out strongly for migration. Recently, you know, he's just said, you know, Spain's a nation of migrants, as every nation basically is, not all, but, you know, and, you know, reminding people that 2 million Spanish fled to Spain under Franco and they were refugees then. And saying, you have a choice. Do you want to be a well-off country and rich, or do you want to be a poor country and struggle? And he's also talking about regularizing almost 1 million migrants that are in Spain, about 300,000 a year, to get them into the workforce. And of course, there are people in Spain working for cash, a little bit different. You know, we have an awful lot of Moroccans and people like that. We're not quite there. Once you're in Spain, it's much easier to get residency here. Their border control hasn't always been the best. They've been pretty hard there and they've done some awful things I don't agree with. Once you're in, there's a lot more routes to residency and stuff like that than there are in many other countries. So there are an awful lot of people who are undocumented and his plan is to document them. They're working anyway. A lot of them are working anyway. So you document them. They pay tax. You know, they enable it. So it's so refreshing to hear that, you know, because we have Vox, the far right, and they are very vocal. But to have a government that stands against them so proudly is such a breath of fresh air, considering like Starmer, who's just kind of on the fence, isn't he? And he doesn't want to upset them too much. And, you know, it's...
Well, I don't know. That press really... press conference today, I think he stepped off the fence and basically on the side of Farage.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
I mean, I think that's what Farage said, and he said Starmer's copying him, and he's not wrong.
He's not. Wow.
He said it about a statement a while ago, but I think about it, you know, net immigration and things like that. But these are the things they said they would do before the election. So if anyone's surprised now,
I mean, this is what annoys me, you know. Matt, a lot before the election, people were telling me I shouldn't be using NRM to sort of speak out against Labour because all this stuff Starmer is saying about the EU and no to customs union, no to this, no to that. He's only saying that to win. And once he's won, he will change his mind. And all the time I was like, there's no way he's going to do that. And to be honest, if he did do that and then the day after the election come out and went, her surprise, we're going to rejoin the EU, that would actually even piss me off. So I'd be like, you fucking lying bastard. Do you know what I mean?
These are the same people that, you know, like, they're like, oh, how did people fall for Boris Johnson's lies? I'm like,
falling for the same lies by a different person, isn't it?
It's what they want to believe, isn't it? They want to believe that, you know, all of these things are possible and that Starmer will do all these things because that's what they want. They're projecting it onto the politician they want to back. And ultimately, that's why I vote Green because I was like, you guys are clowns.
It's the thing I said, wasn't it, Madge? And I said, I'd look through that entire manifesto and there's nothing in there that will fix the economy. And no one, I've been proven right. There's nothing in there.
What about change? What about fastest growth in the G7, huh? That's going to fix the economy. You know, you missed those pages, huh? You missed them pages.
Do you know?
I saw that in an interview and I was like, what? Rachel says, we're going to be the fastest growing. And I'm like, no, you're not.
America. Really okay, not. Buddy. Okay, that's
good. You know, two of the fastest things that bring down an empire in history are disparities. Thank you. Between rich and poor, which we've got. 30% live in poverty. 1% own 50. No, is it nine? Top 1%, isn't it something crazy like 90%? Or is it 50?
It is something really extreme that seems unbelievable, but yeah.
It's top 5% own
90.
90 and the top 1%.
Would anyone like to fact check that for me?
Yeah.
So they didn't say that, they said there'd be no fact checking on this.
Not anymore. And then the other thing that tends to bring down empires is birth rate. There's other stuff. I'm just going on this. And it's really interesting. It's like lots of stuff from history we're just completely forgetting. Like the birth rate's an issue. It's dropped again. And Kemi Badenoch, who has now the potential to go and win the election if it was held tomorrow, is saying she thinks that maternity pay is too much and you're taking it from business. And you're going, we have an issue with our birth rate. You need to get that back up if you want to fix the economy. Not doing it. And it's interesting because those figures that you threw at us, Lisa, those figures would be in line with what that birth rate decline would mean we need to recover in terms of migration. So our birth rate went down from 156 to 144. And that means you probably need an extra 200,000 people a year coming in to be able to replace that based on the mortality rate as well. Those are my own personal calculations. I haven't seen anyone else pull that up, but that's my own calculations. And I'm going, that would then mean that extra 150,000 we've had is exactly what we need to replace that birth rate. And if we're having 500,000 a year leave, that is the exact same thing. So if you had the birth rate, which is about, so it's now 600,000 we need to replace our birth rate, and it's 500,000 a year leaving. That's 1.1 million. Yeah. If you don't have that coming in, it's exactly as you said, Lisa, with the workers. It used to be four workers per pensioner. Now it's two. You've got to work harder for longer in order to keep the old going.
So what is stopping Starmer coming out and doing a press conference and saying what you just said? Instead of the nonsense he come out with today?
I don't think he knows how to deal with the right. And I think a lot of people within his team don't know how to do comms. And imagine I've been saying that, what, 4-6 months now?
I've been saying it for about 2 years, I think. I've been saying it since they briefed against Rayner after the one of the by-election losses early on. I was like, what the fuck are you doing, bro? Like, what's this?
He needs to be offering a clear, simple message alternative to the shit that Nigel and the Conservatives are espousing. And he doesn't do that. And I don't get why. And
he's bad in interviews. He's bad in interviews. That's what it is. He's bad in interviews and he can't convey a message clearly. And that's one of his problems. Like, there's barely any interviews I've seen him where he looks good, apart from the one where they asked him about the petition. But that interview was a joke. That was a complete joke. It is, you know, like, it was a nonsense point that that person was making. But, you know, in around the election, he was not a competent, he was not competent arguing. His policy proposals made no sense. And in the end, like, if you look at this, if you want to talk about cowardice, he was the one who pushed this assisted dying bill. I know we want to talk about this anyways. He was the one that pushed the assisted dying bill because he made a promise to someone that he would put it to Parliament, right? And now he's fucking chickened out because Wes Streeting and Shabana Pamuda basically shivved him and they're pushing against it. So you have the Justice Secretary who'd set out the framework and you've got the Health Secretary who'd probably have to be the one to implement it, right, have completely gone against them publicly. And you're now, you've got this massive rift in the Labour Party and the fucking leader has ran away because he doesn't know what to do. It's the same thing that happened with Cameron with Brexit. You know, once you had Boris Johnson saying, oh, I back Brexit, Cameron's like, oh, shit, there's party unity gone. And it's a complete joke, especially when you have the two most senior ministers on this. Surely, if he was going to push this bill, he would make sure, because Wes Streeting was in his shadow cabinet, and I think Shabana, I don't think she was shadow justice. She might have been. Surely you talk to these people and think, all right, look, I want to put this thing through. What do you think about it? Because if Wes Streeting wasn't back, I'm like, cool, you go get a different role then. Like, it don't make sense. But that's what I mean. You talk about cowardice. He's put a bill in that is very damaging to the party. He's turned it into a free vote, which is fine. But they're incredibly divided on this, and it looks farcical that the health secretary and the justice secretary don't back it. And that's what I mean. He's terrible at, in terms of being a leader, he's not it.
Yeah.
I think there's an element of nuance there. I agree with you on most of the criticisms. I think he's actually done all right in PMQs. I thought the comment he made
about against Kemi, mate. That's like,
I said he did all
that's
right.
Like putting Man United against a League Two team and going, oh, you know, Ruben Amorim, he's looking like a good manager. You're like, mate, that guy's got his part time.
But it still looks good on TV and in clips and on YouTube. When he took out Nigel Farage, that is a video that went viral. And of course, within PMQs and other questions, they can't always respond, which also means he's got complete advantage. And then it looks okay on the comms. And I think some of it has been witty and it's made us laugh. You know, if you can make a political point with an element of comedy, then you're going to make that political point.
Do you know what, though? It winds me up. If I want to watch comedy, I'll go and watch fucking... I'll go and watch various comedians on YouTube, not PMQs. Just quickly, the richest 1% in the UK have 70% of the wealth. Just for it. That's according to AI. So it's definitely true.
That's so wild. But that's what I was saying about history, and we don't learn from it. I mean, we've got... So do you want a history story? I'll try and make it really brief on migration.
Yeah, go
on. Okay, so from what we can tell, originally migrations come in from Persia. And the reason that we know that it's coming from Persia is obviously there's not much in terms of written record in that area. However, there are sagas. So what we think has actually happened is that a group of Persians moved into Central Europe. And then that ended up creating a group called the Germans. And there was a different pronunciation of that name. And the Germans started moving north into areas like Scandinavia. And onto the UK and everywhere else and into Rome. Now, interestingly, the Swedes, when their population grew to a certain size and the Norwegians, and they couldn't grow anymore because of the limitations of farmland and everything else, one of the things obviously we recognize is the fact that they went on this like massive rampage around the world in boats. But they also did a lot in terms of trade. And one of the things that they did in order to figure out where good trade places were was to go back over their old sagas. I think this is in like the 1100s. So they go over their old sagas, and their old sagas talk about where their origins were. So they then followed the sagas, which meant that they had to go south and then across the Volga and lifted their boats over into a new river, which they weren't necessarily sure of because it wasn't with maps, it was with old stories. And these Swedes ended up in Persia again, finding out that actually that was their original origin place. And it was proven by the fact that there was no map. It was an old tale that took them back to where they apparently originated from, which then shows how much migration works. There was an interesting thing with Putin as well, because Putin started banging on about Russians just being this unique race. The Rus are from Norway, so they're from Germans who have gone to become Scandinavians that have gone back to being Russians again. Our entire history is about migration, and you've got a group of lunatics saying how bad it is. And then it's actually destroying our culture. And if anything, all that migrating and moving around is why we have such amazing technologies and understanding of the world. That's my history lesson. I could give you a more.
Listening to the history just like that reminds me of the Stuart Lee segment where he talks about Paul Nuttall of UKIP. I thought he was going to go into that for a minute, Alex.
Would you like to hear just on how good migration can be? Would you like to hear the history of ice cream?
For ice cream?
Of ice cream. This to me is like a massive story as to why migration and civilizations getting together and working together is so good. The origins of ice cream are Persian, and it was originally because they were eating ice and fruit together. And then the Arab Empire came in and were like, oh, actually, why don't we just crush up the ice and we'll crush up the fruit and we'll have it like a sorbet, which is where we get the word sherbet from. It's an Arabic word.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Italians in, I think it's the 1900s, went, oh, this is really good. Why don't we add cream to this? And that's where you get ice cream from. So originated in Persia and moved across the continents. And you're like, isn't that amazing? Sort of like that shows how migration is a good thing. That shows how like civilizations blend and grow and learn.
You're never going to stop people moving.
No.
It's just, it's in our nature as human beings to want to go and try something new, want to go and live somewhere else, you know, either for the experience or for economic reasons or for safety or for, you're never going to stop it, you know. And we don't learn from history. I mean, you know, all the people now have just forgotten the history of the First and Second World War, and how it started and the demonization of other religions or minorities, or it's like, where have you people been? Why can't you recognize this language? You know, because we should understand it, you know, that never again and stuff. I find that really disconcerting, that people who argue against migration, who love Nigel Farage, who will just say, well, are very proud, you know, that we beat Hitler and we won the war and stuff like that. Well, do you not see the similarities here that they're feeding?
I know. A, they wasn't there, so they didn't beat Hitler. B, I hate it when people say, oh, I'm so proud to be British. You was born here by accident. You did not achieve being British. You was just born here by accident. I don't understand about being proud about being British, to be honest. And I'm ex-army. but I've never really understood that whole concept. I think you should be proud of things you've done and achieved. Not proud of where you happened to have been born. You didn't. You had no input into where you were born, have you?
I mean, I know
you can be proud of the country and what we do, and stuff like that. But I don't think you can be proud to be British. It just don't make sense to my tiny brain.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Matt, but we've gone on a bit of a tangent here.
Yeah, that's fine, man.
This is like assisted dying.
Oh shit! Yeah,
I can't even make a joke about assisted dying. We did talk about it earlier. To be fair, we did talk about it in the context of Starmer. To be fair, so I'm not too thingy, but it's yeah.
It's a tough one. This one. I mean, no one wants to see people suffer, right? You don't want to suffer. I was reading about this today because I looked into it to detail. Because I knew we were going to chat on it. And I find some really interesting stuff. Like, so Australia, for one, so 66% of people, it was only 66% of all the people who got the medication actually took the medication to die. And I thought this was one of the most interesting things, and, you know, to do with palliative care and maybe being in control or of having that kind of your own mental health of saying, well, if it gets too bad, then I can do, I have this option. So in Australia, only 66% of people who went through the process, got the medication to aid them in that process, took the drugs for it, which I thought was really interesting. And the other interesting really thing was about it, that 82% of people in palliative care disagree with this bill, which, and you know, they obviously work with, now, they might have completely different views around it, but I thought that was very interesting as well, because I suppose if palliative care is done properly, it does aid that person to die without pain. I mean, doctors will admit this. It's just, you just keep giving the body more and more drugs, more removing the pain with drugs, and eventually the organs will give up and the body will, you know, will give up as well. So I thought that was interesting. And also the arguments about how it could be, people could be coerced. So it's so nuanced, you know, if an old person feels like they're a burden on their family and the coercion. Actually, that as it sits at the moment and the rules around it at the moment, so you have to be going to die within a 6-month period, or you have to be, you know, stuff like that. There's, I think you have to have two reviews, two doctors, goes to the court, high court, and then you've got 14 days, and then you have to take the medication yourself. It's not administered by a doctor, which is a lot of the arguments that about, well, you're asking doctors to kill people and things like that. It's I don't know how I feel about this one, because I can see all sides to it, but I do feel that for dignity on the whole, it's a good thing. But I do, like everyone else, I do worry, I suppose, that legally it'll be challenged. it could go further and further. Some people, experts say it's not going to go further, but sometimes it'd be challenged in court. Well, why can't I have that? I've got this. I want to do that. You know, it's my human right to have the same opportunities as somebody else and things like that. It's really complex. Yeah.
I wonder what the questions are that they actually have to ask and how they test to make sure that you're not having more of a moment within your life than an actual real revelation that you've decided to end your life. Like you're at a down point or you're not with it. And I also sort of wonder for those who feel like, as you said, they're a burden or they don't want to be looked after. I'll never forget my gran, 93, and she, albeit born in Aberdeen, she lived in Yorkshire and probably more associated herself with Yorkshire than she would with Scotland, although very proud of it. She was very independent. If you tried to pull a chair out for her, she'd slap you on the hand. I remember winter, it was Boxing Day, and she's in a wheelchair. We tried to tuck her in, and she went mad. She's like, "Who do you think you are trying to tuck me in? I don't need any help." And you sort of go, wow, you got that sort of independent streak and knowing that you're needing to be looked after, especially if you've been quite an independent woman for your entire life. I could see why potentially for her that would be like, I can't look after myself and do the basics for myself. I don't want to continue.
I think people of that generation especially was quite grafting in younger days, weren't they? We've got my father-in-law living with us. He's 78. No, he's recently been diagnosed with dementia and it's sort of coming on. And already this early on, he's said a number of times, you know, you don't want to be a burden and he feels like a burden. And we have to tell him, you are not a burden. Do you know what I mean? You know, if it weren't for you, the love of my life wouldn't be here next to me. So you're worth looking after sort of thing until you go. So that kind of makes me think about this whole assisted dying thing. And I know there are a lot of things in place, as you said, Lisa, to not just let people do it because they feel like a burden when everyone that looks after them telling them they're not. But that does worry me a bit. But at the same time, I know I would want to die rather than live through years of severe pain. I wouldn't want to live with it, and I wouldn't want to be a burden on my family either.
I don't think any of us do, and I think that's a very common thing. And I think this bill, though, doesn't deal with people who are in a severe state of dementia, who are really suffering, whose bodies, unless they have literally 6 months to live, they will not be able to. And I think that's actually where the legal challenges will maybe come from, is that many people are just kept in homes and you know, no one wants to lose themselves or not recognize their family or, you know, I had a kind of an uncle through marriage and he became very, very ill and he was only in his 50s, early 60s, of rapid onset dementia, and I saw him in a home and he was in a terrible state where he couldn't even lift his head or look at me in the eye and stuff. And I think if he had been in the right state of mind at that point, he would have, you know, I knew him for many years. I was very close to him. I think he would have chosen to go. But so it's a difficult one. I don't think it will affect that many people, really.
No. Statistics in Sweden don't show that. I think it's Sweden, isn't it?
I think it's one of the Scandi countries, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's also, one of the things I find, and this came up with Trump, as well, and what he'd done with Roe v. Wade. And it's this one core thing. Do we have the right to legislate on someone else's body and life? I think that's quite an interesting argument. And I would side with no. I don't think you do have the right to legislate on someone's body. And I find that quite interesting. I'm open to ideas. If someone could persuade me otherwise.
Would you include the smoking ban on that then? Because that is
smoking supposedly as addictive as heroin. Like I've heard that claim before. Would you legalize heroin?
No.
That would be my, like, so I mean, you know, and the big problem we have in the UK is the fact that you've got the NHS, where you've got the social program, but you've got this sort of ethos of total, I'm independent, I should be able to do it. And there's a part of me that goes, if you do that, does it not mean that you're self-inflicting damage, therefore you should be paying more to the NHS. Some people would say, well, we do because we pay tax. Others would say, well, you know, you should have a system where you have to pay more if you've done and self-inflicted this damage. But then you go in this really weird route with that, because you go, well, what if I go and play rugby or football?
That's it.
Like, does that mean I've got to cover myself? And it's like, is that the same or different? And you get into this really
weird, if I get run over crossing the road, you say, well, did I have to cross the road at that point in time?
Yeah, did you look? If you didn't look, well, I mean, that's come up. I think that's come up as an issue, hasn't it, with the cyclists who seem to be running rampage around the whole of Britain, taking people out. What was it 400 accidents a year, I think, was the stat that I saw?
Oh, wow. Okay.
In terms of the assisted dying, but I think on the face of it, there's enough safeguards, especially if it's, you know, getting the 6-month diagnosis might be the toughest bit. I think it makes sense. I mean, I think it is Sweden. There were cases where people would fly to Sweden to die there because they would be allowed to. And there were situations where family members would face the rest for helping their families do that. And it's like, this is crazy, isn't it? So I think, you know, as long as the safeguards are actually put in place, I don't think there's that much of an issue with it. I mean, why should the government stop that kind of thing? If people are on their way out, they're going to die anyways. At least let them decide.
Starmer was asked about it today, and he said
DPP.
DPP, yeah. He said he looked at basically every case while he was in that role of... people that had done what you said just then, Madge, had taken people to Sweden.
Is it Dignitas?
I'll just say Dignitas.
I think it's the incorrect country.
But yeah, so he said, he basically made it pretty clear that he was going to vote for assisted dying, but wouldn't say them actual words, because he said he saw all of the cases that come through in that role, and he felt very, very strongly about it and for the families that went through it. In other words, he agrees with assisted dying and is going to vote that way. But I don't, you know, when it, like you said earlier, Madge, if he's got other people in the cabinet giving their opinions, he might as well give his, isn't it?
Yeah, but the party's fractured on this issue. Like I said, it looks pretty bad at the moment. And so, like, that's the problem he's run into. And he's not strong enough to kind of put up a united front. I think that's the problem. The stuff with Shabana Mahmood is pretty crazy, because she was arguing on religious grounds, as well as arguing the safeguards weren't enough. And then you're like, right, so you're telling me that the party you represent have not put the safeguards in to deal with it. Now, that sounds very incompetent or very lazy, in my opinion. So you're calling your colleagues stupid. Like, that's the only way I can read into that. You're calling your own colleagues, your own people, right, stupid. Because how else do you argue against that? Now, if she's saying, you know, whoever, Kim Leadbeater, who put in the legislation, I think, you're calling her an idiot because she has not put the safeguards in place, and she's pushing a thing that a policy which people could suffer through coercion, essentially forced death, faster than it had to be. And, you know, that's one hell of a thing to do to your own colleague, in my opinion.
Can we for once actually just have a nice news story? Can we actually, like, oh, so bloody negative.
Well, if you want a nice one, there's at least a temporary ceasefire in Lebanon. If you want a positive story, I'll give you that. That's the only positive story I've seen this week, and I'm fucking happy. At least something's moving on that.
There's the second. It's the free school meals.
Oh, they started rolling out the free school meals thing. Yeah, that's good.
I've got a good news story. Kendrick Lamar's new album come out. And it's banging. Okay. Everyone's wanging on about that.
Here's another one. Drake put in two different lawsuits against his record label and his Kendrick. So that's pretty funny. It's funny.
Because he lost a rap beef.
Yeah, he's put the information. And I'm like, you called him a wife beater. So, you know, he's got a case against you, pal.
It's not funny. We just have to look to America.
New story.
You know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's good, but it's funny. You know, it's like I say, the casting for Trump's new reality TV show is coming together nicely.
Alex, who did you say the characters were in the main protagonist in this? Trump.
Jordan Peterson is calling them the Avengers. What did you call them?
The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
On that happy note,
we need five.
No, five. No, it's four. It's biblical. It's four. It's biblical. I'm not coming up with a fifth.
Misinformation. Be long lost. That's the best one.
On that happy note, thank you so much to our guests. Thank you to my lovely co-host.
Thank you.
If you want to see their channels and what they're doing, links are in the description. If you like what you saw today, hit that like and subscribe button. Bye, everyone. Hail to the lamp.
Hail to
the lamp.
Bye, guys.
Tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.